Hello and welcome to this edition of Planet Science, with me, Hugh Manning.
And me, Christopher Millington. On today's show, we'll be discussing a self-replicating machine that could revolutionise third-world manufacturing. We also have a special report on paired kidney transplants, the first operation of which took place earlier this week.
Before the act, you could only donate an organ if you were genetically related or there was a close friend. But now you can do it anonymously, so you can donate your organ to somebody you don't know. You don't know who it is until after the operation.
And finally, we'll be discussing the advent of commercial space travel with a representative from Virgin Galactic, the first commercial space travel company, and one of its first passengers.
But first, we're all now laden down with a plethora of portable electronic devices, which are shrinking all the time. A major limitation on this miniaturisation, however, is making the tiny displays legible. A novel approach to this problem has been taken by researchers in Seattle, who are planning to incorporate them into novel contact lenses. With more on this, we have our technology correspondent, Marie Kirsten.
Yes, today a new contact lens, a prototype, was presented by a group in Washington University. And this contact lens contains built-in LEDs and circuits so that it can be used as a tiny personal display. The assistant professor, Babak Parviz, who is an assistant professor of electrical engineering, says it's very useful, as currently available electronic devices, such as mobile computers and phones, are mainly limited in size due to their displays. So he had the idea of integrating the displays on the lens.
So how far along are these lenses developed, Marie, and when will we be seeing them in the shops?
What actually sounds like a gadget from the future is still in the future, so it's not being applicable yet. So far, the only thing they've achieved is the incorporation of high-performance circuits, including LEDs, onto these transparent, flexible plastic substrates. There's no possibility yet for incorporating transmission of power or data into these lenses, and without this, these lenses are useless.
So how are the researchers planning to overcome these limitations?
The research group has plans to transmit power by using radio frequency or alternatively using photovoltaic cells. For using the radio frequency, antenna would have to be installed on these lenses, and these could also be used for transmission of the data. So this could be a good idea.
So what kind of applications do you and the researchers themselves see for this kind of technology?
The researchers say it could be a good improvement for people who have impaired eyesight, for example, who can't see contrast very well. And by using these LEDs directly in front of their eyes, these patients could have a better, higher life standard.
These lenses have been described as a folly in some quarters. Why do you think this is so?
I think these lenses are quite... So there has been Professor Wolfson who has expressed doubts about these lenses because he says that actually it's not possible to use this very low space on the lens to include enough LEDs to make sense. So he has indicated that the same technique has been used to install on glasses, and here he sees a good future for this technology.
Thank you, Marie. So now we're going to move on to talk about the idea of a self-replicating machine, which has been called RepRap. The idea of a self-replicating machine has been dreamt about since the dawn of the Enlightenment, yet has always seemed just beyond our grasp. However, now it seems it is a reality. Last week, Dr. Adrian Bauer from the University of Bath unveiled the RepRap at the Cheltenham Science Festival. The RepRap is essentially a rapid prototyper like those used by designers and engineers. It has been developed to be capable of building copies of itself. The creation is being marked as the start of a new era in robotic manufacturing. Here in the studio, we have Dr. Hayley Powell, a robotics engineer from the University of Warwick, in the studio.
Hiya.
So my question is, so can this machine actually build itself yet?
Well, at the moment, it's still in its kind of early stages. So it can build things like crude plastic objects, so they have it making things like sandals and coat hooks, fly swatters, really simple things like that. And they're moving on to make it actually make all of its own plastic components. So everything at the moment is made out of plastic. However, of course, it's going to be more complicated and building up to make more and more sophisticated things. So eventually it'll be able to build all its own circuitry and everything and put itself together, a copy of itself together. Also, it's they're working on making it so it can recycle plastics as well to put onto it, so it's got this extra thing as well. So
sounds excellent. But how long would it take to perform such tasks? I mean, how long to make a sandal, say, and then in the future, how long to make another rep wrap from scratch by itself?
Yeah, that's the other thing. It's currently extremely slow, and it's actually quite laborious to watch it. I saw it at the Cheltenham Science Festival last week, and it actually takes about 2 hours to make a sandal, unfortunately. But if you remember back in the days when... So I guess at the moment it'd probably take over a week to recreate itself. But if you remember back in the days when the first digital images were taken, it took hours and hours to process, and now you can do it in a second. I think the makers envisage that this is going to be a similar kind of thing.
So is this really a revolutionary machine? Have we not seen this before?
Yes, well, just imagine the possibilities that you can have with a self-replicating machine. I mean, on the kinds of science fiction levels, you can look at unmanned spacecraft. You can send these robots out into space and they can replicate themselves and then make colonies, make whatever they want up there. They can even make spaceships up there to go further afield. So it's really exciting in terms of in the far future. But more practically, in kind of the short term, they're really perfectly suited for producing production lines, basically, in the developing world. And these are the things that the creators themselves envision them to be used for. So, I mean, fabrication line production is an extremely expensive business. So you're looking at $500 million to produce one of these things, which the third world countries can't afford at the moment. But if you have one machine, which then can make another machine, and then those machines can build a fabrication line, all you need really is the cost of the materials needed to build it, yeah. Basically.
So we're talking about some very cutting-edge technology here and talking about putting it into the third world. And obviously cost there will be a real issue. So how much would you envisage that the first of these kind of machines will cost?
Well, actually, they make these things at the moment for only about £250.
Wow.
And the really nice thing about this is that the guys that are making it are not planning on charging anyone for these things for a number of reasons. Firstly, because the whole issue is like they can patent it and they can ask people for royalties for it, but then you're essentially stopping the machine doing from what it's meant to be doing, basically. And the other thing is, imagine I had a self-replicating machine, I sold it to you for £1,000, so then you made it self-replicate and then you'd start selling it for £900 a piece, putting me out of business. So basically it's going to be free.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much for that, Dr. Powell. And now we'll move on to an exciting story from the world of medicine. And two couples are celebrating this week after a successful kidney transplant. Now, that's not too unusual, you might think, but this is the first time in the UK that organs have been donated outside family or friendship groups. This development may do wonders for waiting lists, but it does raise some ethical questions. And Paul Gibson now reports.
The changes came about after high-profile scandals at Alderhay Hospital in Liverpool, where organs were removed without patients' consent. Chris McNeil is a spokesperson for the Human Tissue Authority, the organ donation regulator.
The Act basically lets non-directed organ donation. So before the Act, you could only donate an organ if you were genetically related or there was a close friend. But now you can do it anonymously. So you can donate your organ to somebody you don't know. You don't know who it is until after the operation.
In this procedure, a Cambridge-based man donated his kidney to a man in Scotland. In return, the Scottish man's wife donated her kidney to the Cambridgeshire man's spouse. John Forsyth, a surgeon at Adam Brooks Hospital in Cambridge, performed the procedure on the southern couple.
The actual procedure hasn't actually changed. The biggest difference is the fact that we've had to do multiple operations simultaneously with two pair couples. The logistics of it wasn't too much of a problem. The team itself were fantastic in the sense that we had two theatres together, and the operation ran very smoothly.
John Smith, the Cambridgeshire-based donor, says the operation went well.
There haven't been any ill effects from the donation. I just noticed an improvement in my quality of life, mainly because my wife's life has improved, so she's more able to do things. I don't have to take her for dialysis 3 times a week. Everything's better.
But this relaxing of the law has raised ethical concerns, one of which is the likelihood of a black market in organs springing up as more potentially become available.
The purpose of the Human Tissue Authority to monitor the process very, very closely, and I can assure you there won't be any black market transactions of organs. You have an independent assessor there who assesses the process, and the donor, you know, he receives a lot of counselling in order to make sure he knows exactly what he is doing.
What I think I'm doing is fantastic, and I'm giving a new lease of life to my patients, so I'm very pleased about that.
John Forsyth there, ending that interesting report from Paul Gibson.
Now for a report on commercial space travel. So we have all at one time or another dreamt of travelling into space, but so far this has only been achieved by a handful of highly trained astronauts. However, now we are on the verge of commercial space travel with the first so-called space line company, Virgin Galactic, which has started taking bookings for commercial space travel, and with the first flights planned for takeoff early in 2009. To talk about this the advent of commercial spaceflight, we have in the studio two guests, Antonio Nielsen from Virgin Galactic and the Greek millionaire Nicholas Dolasky, who has been booked on the first space flight planned early for next year. So, Nicholas, so how do you feel about being on the first commercial space flight?
Yeah, it was my dream since I was a kid, but I had to look after my dad's fleet, so I could never fulfill my dream to become an astronaut, so I think this is a chance now.
You mean your dad's fleet of ships?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Antonio, if I paid my hard-earned $200,000 to Richard Branson, what kind of experience would I expect in return?
Well, you'll start your space adventure by going on a 3-day training course where it will teach you how to make the most out of space flight and zero gravity. And we also have to establish that you're fit to undertake space flight. In the flight itself, you will go up to an altitude of 110 kilometers, and the flight time from takeoff to touchdown takes approximately 2.5 hours, including 6 minutes of zero-G. And while you're in zero-G, you'll be allowed to unstrap yourself from your seat and float around the cabin.
So it's a very exciting experience, I can tell. But Nicholas, are you at all concerned about the CO2 output of these kind of commercial space flights, which, it has been said in some quarters, is most probably equivalent to around 20 times going around the Earth in a car?
Well, I don't think it will be so much more than the usual aeroplane trips. And it's a dream, so I would like to do it.
So Antonio, can you tell us more about the design of this so-called spaceship?
Well, the spacecraft is designed on a 3-fuselage plane, with the middle fuselage being the shuttle component, which houses the astronauts. The spacecraft take off like a normal plane on a runway and flies up to high altitude, reaching speeds faster than fighter jets. The middle bit then detaches from the main craft and boosts up into space using a rocket engine.
Currently, the price of this commercial space flight is $200,000. This is only available to the super rich at the moment. Do you envision in the future that maybe the common man could eventually travel into space at an affordable price?
Well, obviously, the initial pricing is set very high. The technology is not cheap to develop, and there's, of course, high operating costs. We want fuel and so on and so forth. I really think that it's a wonderful and very exciting opportunity, and we already plan for pricing to go down significantly after the first 100 customers. So hopefully, soon average Joe can become a space cowboy.
Can you tell us what the price will go down to after the first 100 customers?
Well, hopefully it can go down to 100,000.
So from 200,000 to 100,000?
Yeah, hopefully.
So that's already a 50% reduction.
That's what we're targeting for.
And so Nicholas, I mean, how do you feel about being a trailblazer in this kind of thing? I mean, how do you feel about maybe the safety implications of this? How do you feel about being the first man to do this?
Well, I feel very proud of this. I have been taking risks throughout my career, so I would like to do it, and I think this is I would fulfill a dream of my childhood. So I don't mind the risks involved in this. I think it will make the trip more enjoyable.
So you're not worried about the risks at all of being strapped to a rocket and
no
going into a vacuum of space?
No. I'm Greek, so I'm going to enjoy the experience.
Antonio, are you going to be on one of these first space flights? As you're so involved in the build-up to this, do you feel jealous that you're not going to be going?
Yeah, obviously. I think a lot of people would think that it's quite a wonderful thing to do. So hopefully the pricing will go down, as I said.
Okay, excellent, guys. And we wish you both the best of luck in your future endeavours, and make sure you come back in and tell us all about it and send us some of those great holiday snaps I'm sure you'll have. Now, thanks very much for listening to this week's show. And if you have any comments or suggestions on this week's show, if you log on to our website at www.planetscience.com, where my co-host, the glamorous Christopher Millington, will be hosting a web chat straight after this. And for those people who entered last week's competition, our question was, which fruit has been shown to be a possible Viagra substitute? And the answer, of course, is the watermelon. And our congratulations go to our lucky winner, Mr. Gareth Mitchell of London. On next week's show, we'll be discussing global warming, embryo-derived stem cells, and other such exciting tasks. So for this week from Planet Science, it's goodbye from me, Hugh Manning.
It's goodbye from me, Christopher Millington.
And thank you very much for listening.